Lauren is going to play ENT doctor. Does anyone else have any expertise in ENT medicine? Know anything about it?
Okay.
Okay, so Lorraine and Lauren can play ENT doctor. Robin, how about cardiology? Who knows anything about cardiology?
Well, I'm a rheumatologist, so I know a little bit about cardiology.
I don't know your name. What's your name?
Dinesh.
Okay, we'll call you D. Okay, Dinesh. So you're going to play cardiologist. I'm going to let my communist play a Republican. So Lenny, you're going to be the Republican. And then I'll let a real Republican, Lenny, play the other Republican. So you're playing Republicans. So you have to get your Republicans. And I don't know who else I'm going to assign to do anything. All right, so we're here to talk about, I trust you've read all three of these documents. If not, grab your food and leave. Okay? There were three documents that were circulated by the memo. One was Alan Garber's document of problem solving in a polarized age, comparative effectiveness research, and the politicalization of evidence-based medicine. The second was the little thing that I wrote. And the third was the Institute of Medicine, 100 initial priority topics for comparative effectiveness research. And unlike the last one I sat into that had that Bob Kaplan had 255 PowerPoint slides, I decided that we would do all this without a single PowerPoint slide and without me standing up at all. So the topic for today to start out with, so my two Republicans have to answer the first question. Why would you as a Republican vote for funding comparative effectiveness research? As a Republican, what's the underlying belief of why you would vote for funding, for spending a billion dollars for comparative effectiveness research? Now, do all of you know how comparative effectiveness research got funded this time? Somebody tell me what happened? Where is it? Where did it get started from? What's the general facts? I don't know what the heck you know. So
I think
tell me.
$1 billion through American
Recovery,
the stimulus fund, basically.
So in the stimulus fund, we gave somebody to GM, we gave somebody to Freddie Mac, and all these other. We gave a billion dollars to comparative effectiveness work, right? As part of the stimulus.
$400 million of that somehow got. I'm not sure.
Okay, so it was divided between three agencies, the NIH. How many of you actually wrote grants, applications for any of this money? Did you get it?
No.
Okay. Do you know the success rate for writing grants under this budget? What was the success rate?
1 or 2%.
1%. How much time did you spend writing the grant?
About a month.
What?
About a month.
Of your salary?
What's that?
Of your time?
Yeah.
How much other people's time?
Not much.
Not much. So it was mostly you because we supported infrastructure at UCLA to make you successful.
Yeah.
Okay, so you spent a month of your time. Now I'm going to argue that when you take overhead and fringe rates and whatever, we'll figure that you're worth about $300,000 a year. And if you did 11 months, that means it was about $40,000. How big of a grant did you write for?
We wrote a...
What?
Dollar amount?
Yeah.
$2 million.
So you requested for 30, you put $30,000 of investment into a $2 million grant. Okay, if I multiply 30,000 times 100, what do I come up with? For those of you that have taken multivariate analysis, what is the number? What? And what did he write for a grant?
$2 million, I thought.
So the purpose of comparative effectiveness was to take people away from doing things that were productive, to fund them on writing grants, and to burn up forests and trees? Or did you do it all computerized?
No, it was.
Did you have to submit paper?
Yes.
Okay. So we got the forests and the trees. Really? I mean, so, but if you're a Republican in Congress, why would you vote for this, Lenny?
I would not.
Why would you not?
Because people are just going to use it to ration.
What?
People are just going to use it to ration healthcare.
Okay.
And I don't think we should spend money on this stuff anyway when we have a deficit.
Okay.
So, if you're a Republican, you wouldn't vote for it in the stimulus package, but you may vote for comparative research. Because the that the idea would be in the long term to only do things that are highly beneficial and cut out everything else so that it's more economically motivated.
So we have plenty of private industries doing enough research on what drugs are best to treat patients. Why should the government fund it?
But it's all biased in industry. Study the questions you really need answered.
All right, so Robin, my first cardiologist, the first thing on the strategy for the IOM is compare the effectiveness of treatment strategies for atrial fibrillation, including surgery, catheter ablation, and pharmacological treatment. Is that the most important thing in cardiology that needs to be studied by comparative effectiveness?
I think it's a worthy question.
Okay. Who should fund it? And what should be the, I mean, why, if you were now going to talk to Newt Gingrich and try to convince him to fund this, why would he be funding this? He's over there.
Newt now.
it's a chronic illness that affects millions of patients and it's causing hospitalizations and worse disease. And
Come here.
You almost said I don't bite, but you knew that wasn't true.
No, they do bite.
So we, if we can determine one therapy, with the best therapy.
Shouldn't the best therapy be a choice between a patient and their doctor?
Absolutely. But the doctor's got to have the information to provide to the patient.
We have lots of information. We have already funded.
Okay, so let's get over this issue. What did the bill do to deal with the issue that Lenny's raising, that this would the data would actually be used?
Prohibits its use for any.
So what did it do?
Services.
Do you know?
Can't be used for coverage.
What?
Shouldn't be used for coverage decisions.
The bill actually writes into law that comparative effectiveness work cannot be used for coverage, cannot be used for guidelines, and what happens if you die? Do somebody come out and shoot you? Does the CIA pick you up? The FBI pick you up? What's the penalty if you do that? You get whatever money you have, whoever you are, you get terminated. You get, this is a new job for Schwarzenegger. I mean, the language is really tough about that it should not be used by any, so we now overcame that. We're not going to use it other than by God. Who's God? Who's God?
The doctor.
The doctor. The only person submitted, our rheumatologist or somebody or our ophthalmologist or whoever we got around the room, they're the only ones that are able to use this. On a penalty of law. Okay, so that was the compromise, and why was that said that way? Why did the Republicans not want this to be used to ration? What do Republicans stand for?
Small government.
Small government. What do they balance budgets? Why would they not want medical care to be, what's behind the thinking that would say that they should oppose something that could lead to containing the federal budget? What's the logic if you sat down and talked to them?
Because the decision should be between the physician and the patient. That's their argument.
So it's the state's rights taken down to the patient and the doctor.
And they thought it was a political hot button that they could hit.
Okay, so could they take over Congress by convincing the Democrat that the Democrats would be put into the position of actually controlling medical care costs? Now, I really don't know. Somebody ought to do the study, to do the quiet interviews, just like the Pentagon Papers were produced, and the Afghan stuff was produced. Somebody ought to do a study to basically answer the question, what really were people thinking when they voted against, when they put these restrictions on? So look at Don Berwick. Don Berwick was not confirmed as head of CMS. Don funded an organization, ran an organization called IHI, which is a group that is the premier organization in the country to do quality improvement. His greatest sin in life is he trained all these people to do quality improvement. Very successful not-for-profit business. So successful that the Queen actually knighted him in the UK. He is Sir Donald Berwick, believe it or not, and he's knighted for this organization. He can't get confirmed because he was on record as saying that, you know, the NHS is a pretty good deal. So he gets appointed as an interim appointment to do this. So is the whole thing going on in Washington, do Republicans really want, if they were in control, if they actually controlled the presidency, the Congress, would they vote for this? What do you think, Lenny? Or anyone else? You think they would vote for it? Why not, if they're in control?
Well, we know back from the mid-90s when, you know, AHP CPR tried to set up these guidelines, it backfired with back pain and so forth. So they don't want to implement any guidelines.
Republicans? What happened when guidelines? Does any of you remember the story of what happened when the agency now for that most of us get our money from actually started to produce guidelines? Does anyone know what happened? Does anyone know the story?
It was the orthopedic surgeons who weren't happy about it.
Well, does anyone know the story specifically?
But didn't the senator have acting and he was kind of, I don't know what senator it was, he was a Republican senator who felt he was undergoing multiple procedures and felt that there was...
Okay, so it was all about something called a pedicle screw. Do I have anyone that knows what a pedicle screw is? I don't know what a pedicle screw is. And luckily I don't have one. Does anyone know what a pedicle screw is? Okay, well, the rheumatologists must, but the orthopods were putting in something called a pedicle screw. The head of the clinical scholar program at Washington, University of Washington, that day, wrote an analysis and a guideline that was funded by the agency, the U.S. government, that said there's no evidence to support pedicle screws. They should not be paid for or put in. One orthopedic surgeon in that wonderful part of the country called Louisiana, one orthopedic surgeon formed a group called the Patient Care Center, had one fax machine, no employees, and spent his life, I think, operating on the wrong patients and sending faxes to everybody, identical faxes, all day and night, all night long, I think, to everybody in Congress. One surgeon. What did the orthopedic surgeons do as a group? What did they do? This is one surgeon. Basically saying things like this is fascism, it's communism, whatever's on this fax, but don't, you know, defund the agency, get rid of the whole program. What did the orthopedic surgeons do? Because nothing. Why? If you were head of the Society of Orthopedic Surgery or the college, why wouldn't you do something about this? You mean here's an evidence-based report produced to physicians, you can defund the whole agency. The agency was zeroed out. The budget for the agency was zeroed out. Defund a whole agency? It's like defunding the NIH that does cancer research on the basis that somebody that can, you know, is doing stem cell maybe, or maybe just decided that, you know, they ought to look at breast cancer and we really only want to look at prostate cancer. Funded the whole agency. Came very close. It was only because of one senator that did not get defunded. What should the professional society do? If you're leading it, many of you are going to lead these professional societies, what would you have done? Does anyone have any gonads? What would you do?
You've got to fight up against all the practitioners who are going to push back.
How many of them, so you're a health services researcher, you're not just a politician. So you might want to ask the question, how many of my members actually believe in this thing? How many people do I really have to fight against? Is it 1, 2, 10, 100? I mean, somebody might have turned to a program that produces you and say, hey, spin the data. How would you have gotten that data? Where is the data? Could somebody have spun it quickly? Where do you get it from? Do you know?
The members of your, whatever your...
Well, I mean, sure. So this is an inpatient operation. It's coded with a CPT code and a diagnosis. Presumably, in a free country with transparency and an administration that said, okay, we would like to give you this data tomorrow, not 20 years after you go through 9,000 IRBs, because it'll be disidentified, and not in a form that takes you and 22 statisticians and 19 programmers to figure out what variables coded. Give it to us in a form that tomorrow we can give to the head of the president of the orthopedic surgery group the information. How many of these procedures are done by which members of their society? They come from what state? Maybe even what congressman district? Would you do that kind of study? Make that your life's work to help the presidents of the specialty societies deal with idiotic members of their own society? Now, I don't know whether you're a Republican or a Democrat. That I don't know. But it just shows the power in this day of internet of one fax machine and how much damage to be done. One fax machine, one person, and the inability of professional organizations to control anything. In terms, it's the opposite of the Department of Medicine. In terms of ability to control, or the military. And one person did all this. This is democracy really in action, right?
Well, I think at the same time, there was a lot of question about back surgery in general going on, and I think the orthopedic field felt under attack, and so this was a match that landed on an area that was ready to go up in flames. The whole question of, you know, who you operate on for backs and what works and what doesn't work. So it may have been the right time for something to explode.
Okay. Lots of hypotheses of what happened. As far as I know, somebody may be writing it up at this moment, but it would be a marvelous study to go back now and figure out who the leaders are and do a historical analysis, either by talking or looking what was written, and use some of the social science fields that many of you have been are going to get training in to actually ask the question, how does a medical society actually function in this world? So I'll flip the thing around. Then we'll finally get to Alan Garcia and Alan Garber's points. I became friends of the American College, what is the Society of Chemotherapy people? What do they call themselves? What are they?
Society of Clinical
Oncologists. So I met the new president of the Society of Clinical. This was a few years ago. And he came to me and said, Bob, I want to make my presidential address about the quality of care given in cancer. And I need your help. So I said, I'm going to take you to the NIH. Because the Cancer Institute was at that time the only institute in the NIH that really had a serious program in looking at quality. And I sat down with the leaders of it, many of whom are like you, were trained in schools of public health, were health services researchers. And here I'm bringing the head of the college, and he's saying, my presidential address is going to be about quality. It's the first time ever that anyone has talked about anything other than money or basic science. Talk about quality. And I said, you guys are doing all these marvelous studies. Will you help him by providing the information to make this speech have meaning? What do you think they said? It's you guys, 10 years later, except for some of the old people in the room. This is our government. We're paying them for our tax dollars. What did they say? Why did they say no?
Because they have to do work beyond what they're asked to do. They're not interested. They don't want to.
That's part of it, but their argument was it had not been published yet. And therefore, if they presented anything at a national meeting, and they would risk their publication. And I said, this guy's only got a presidential term for 1 year. and he wants to change a major part of American medicine. He's willing to take a risk. You're not going to help him, they said no. So at the end of this meeting, we sat down. I think they were all Democrats, by the way. At the end of this meeting, we sat down, and they were all public health people. We sat down, I said, at a bar, and, you know, literally said, you know, what can you do? How do you actually move or go when you take advantage of an opportunity? So this is an interesting problem in the field, and there are lots of forces out here. We know very little about the political context and the forces in the field that will make it a government process to try to say that you ought to fund comparative effectiveness work. So now let's look at this first question here. Why shouldn't industry fund this first question? Robin.
Because you're
going out, you're going to be a cardiologist. You're not, but you're going to be a cardiologist. You've really been trained in all the statistical methods. Why should you not say it's industry's job to fund the answer to this question?
Because they have a stake in finding a particular outcome.
Who funds all the controlled clinical trials, the drugs, when you have to go in front of the FDA?
Pharmaceutical company.
What?
Pharmaceutical company.
Sure.
Right.
Do you think we ought to take that over and pay for that out of taxpayer dollars? I mean, directly out of taxpayer dollars.
But that's not the criteria to get approval. It's not comparative effectiveness studies. That's the problem. There's a misalignment of what kinds of studies they fund that are required to get the approval versus comparative effectiveness. They're not the same.
Okay. I'm not, so does everyone understand Barbara's point?
They choose easy targets to compare their drug to. They choose, like, they just study their drug versus a placebo or versus, like, a,
right.
You know, a drug that they think they're going to show benefit.
I don't know if it differs across diseases. For a lot of neurologic disease, it's against placebo, and there's no incentive at all to compare existing treatments. Not for FDA approval.
Okay, so FDA has a complicated approval system. Part of it is for safety. And part of it is for efficacy. Now, on the efficacy side, doing studies against a placebo, even if there's something else in the market, as long as it's ethical, you have to design an ethical study. So I don't know, would the IRB at UCLA approve now a new statin against a placebo for somebody with, if you're on the IRB, who wants to sit on an IRB, would they approve a new statin against this placebo? In people that just had a heart attack and have high cholesterol? So in essence, if you are trying to demonstrate effectiveness or efficacy, some of it is comparative effectiveness work. So we'd have to go back and look at somebody would have to go back and actually pull the literature here to look at what kind of studies have been done to compare atrial fibrillation and with other, in atrial fibrillation with other sorts of issues. Is anybody interested enough to doing that? And what if you decided that, hey, you don't need randomized trials, you can do observational study, you can do modeling, all the stuff that you're learning, and you really can get a pretty good handle at that. What do you think? Who should fund that? So now if I take the editor of JAMA and I say to JAMA, you agree with the editor of the New England Journal that if you're going to do a comparative effectiveness study using any method that you do, not just a randomized trial, but any method, that if you want to publish it in a major journal, you have to register it. Like you have to register controlled trials now. So you have to register. If I'm losing anyone, let me know that you have to actually register your analysis. So if anyone's going to do even the simplest thing, let's say you're going to do a comparative effectiveness study, Lorraine, at the end of adding a another pediatric trauma center to the Valley, which is what you want to do. And you would have to register that analysis. If you want to publish it in any reputable journal, you would have to register that now. So if the results come out in a way that you don't like, and I know which way you want them to come out, if the results come out in a way you don't like, then we at least could call you up and say, did you not publish it because you got bored, you got a life, you decided that something else was more important to do, or the results didn't come out the way you liked it.
That's already the case, though.
What?
That's already the case, though.
Mm-hmm. Only for randomized trials.
Randomized, yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And even with the randomized trials, it's still the same bias. The studies that are negative or don't go the way the pharmaceutical company wants it, they never publish. And then you try to call them, which I've tried to do as a part of meta-analysis, they say, we can't share that with you. Mm-hmm. So that continues to be the same problem.
But I thought any time someone had like signed a consent form to be involved in a trial, if you don't publish that data, that's a violation.
That's an ethical violation.
Should be. Like,
so when you guys as fellows don't finish your research, you go off to decide if you want to be a clinician or change the world or, you know, scale the moon or whatever the hell you're going to do, and you don't publish your results, should I call you unethical? We actually probably are the only fellowship program that actually put in a rule that basically, which we don't follow because we don't follow any rules in this program, we put in a rule that said your faculty mentor is responsible for publishing the results. Now, but what? How do you enforce that? If I write it up in one day and I write it in, you know, a language that nobody can understand, namely first year fellow language, and I submit it off to somebody, and they say, no way, Jose, I can't understand the second word, is that the faculty do their job? And the answer is probably not. And so what do I do with the faculty? They're all tenured. So I can shoot them. But beyond that, what do I really do? What is the standard, the moral standards of anybody, academics or anybody? And I will argue that the stuff that you will go forward with and actually publish in your life, in terms of the amount of effort you make to publish it, will be almost independent of your funding source. You, in this room, it will be far more dependent on what the results show. And if you find something that you really don't believe, you probably will put much less effort into trying to get it published than if you find something that you believe in, unless that's the last paper that you need to get tenure. So, but it is the case that, so how would you change the registration of controlled trials?
Well, I think there should be a mandate to publish, whether it's a positive or a negative study. The registration is the first step towards that. But there should be a mandate to publish that.
So if you were head of whatever, what would you tell Kathy DeAngelis to do? Since she doesn't like Merck and a lot of these other pharmaceuticals, what would you tell her to do?
That any study that is submitted by a pharmaceutical company and they have...
How about an academic? How about an assistant professor? I mean, at UCLA. Well, I mean, I don't care where they come from, do you? So if Lorraine registers a study, finishes it, and then goes off and doesn't publish it, what should we do to Lorraine? Or UCLA,
have the data available, whatever, 3-5 years after the study's finished, have the data publicly available for anything that's not published.
So the thing is, you have to change the way that journals accept and reject articles. They're going to accept an article with a positive result many more times than they're going to accept something with a negative result, unless it's just like a change in the standard of care.
No. So you post the ones you can't get published on the internet somewhere, you can find the data. So you write, you know, that'd be easy.
You know, I don't know how many of you work with pharmaceutical companies. I direct a scleroderma program here and do a lot of that. And if you ever read through the confidentiality agreement you signed with them, starts at 20 pages and go on. And a part of that is that you can't tell, and the issue is that exactly what you're talking about. So it's good to think about those ideas, but the rules and regulation and how industries tries to protect their bottom line is just unbelievable.
Okay, so we have people here that believe that pharmaceutical companies are like tobacco companies.
Having worked with them, yes.
Well, I'm glad. Okay. So now let me add one other thing to the fire, and then let's try to figure out what we would do. So when I was a government officer, when I was a program officer in what now is the Agency for Healthcare Research or Quality, I gave money to a very bright person at Yale named Shannon Grunges, who in the outpatient clinic at Yale, this was in 1972, in the outpatient place at Yale in 1972, developed an electronic medical record that was just marvelous. And I gave him a lot of federal money. And I go up to site visit him and I say, well, when are you gonna take this to scale? What did he tell me? What do I mean, take it to scale?
Disseminate it.
You know, market it. Where are the, I mean, in those days, and I'm sorry to be offensive, but in those days, they were all men physicians. There weren't many women physicians. And any time we wanted physicians to do anything, we'd hire people with blonde hair and correct the physique and pom-poms. And my wife used to call them our pom-pom girls. And they would go off and cheer. And they could get appointed with any of these male chauvinist pigs that we call heads of departments. And the bottom line is that they would basically, you know, get in the door. Getting in the door was 90% of the game. Sell it. Where are his pom-pom girls? Where was his marketing? We didn't have an internet. So where was his marketing approach? What did he tell me?
Publish a paper on it.
What?
He was going to publish a paper on it?
Yeah. Well, he's an academic. He did what he did. It's up to somebody else to do it. Now, fast forward a third of a century later, we at RAND have developed the best materials to help kids in elementary school overcome post-traumatic stress syndrome. Hands down, proved in a randomized trial, makes a difference in grades, it does everything. We got all sorts of awards. Talk to my researchers, they're not doctors, and they work for RAND and not a university. And I say, well, shouldn't we gear up marketing and dissemination? What's their response?
Well, we did.
We did our job. What are you around for, Bob? Now, by law, one of the laws that's in the NIH, when you get a grant from the NIH, by law, if you find something useful to the American population, you by law have to disseminate it. By law. Now, nobody ever pays attention to that law. But there's a law when the NIH was established and authorized that said you're responsible for actually doing something that comes pretty close to marketing. Nobody pays any attention to that, or very few, except if you can get venture capital and turn it into a for-profit event. So how is the Department of Cardiology at Hopkins funded? Somebody from Hopkins is probably on the phone and they'll tell me I'm wrong, but how was it at least funded for a long period of time? They actually developed a very sophisticated angioplasty catheter. Like you, you're the cardiac fellow, you go to a lab, they developed it. Who gets the, what happens to the intellectual property?
University.
What?
University.
What is the agreement? Has anyone signed an intellectual property agreement with anybody, ever? I mean, have you signed it and read it? Don't believe you're ever going to produce intellectual property. Okay, so in most universities, the intellectual property agreement is half the money goes somewhere above the department. Quarter of the money stops at the department, and you personally get a quarter of all the royalties. So if you're head of cardiology, you really, I mean, you're going to get all this money, and you need money to fund all you bright fellows. Robin needs money, he has to eat, he wants to have 9 children, all this other kind of stuff. I mean, it has to happen. So there's a lot of pressure everywhere economically. So now let's come back to our question. I mean, is there some way one could convince what ought to be the balance of funding of comparative effectiveness trials? So in one argument, you could say to the company that developed the catheter ablation technique, if you want Medicare to cover this, here are the explicit trials that you need to do. Otherwise, we won't cover it. You've proved it's within some bounds of safety, but we'll put a black label on it that says it's never been compared to medical therapy. We don't know the answer to the question. And the government's role could be simply to say, we're not going to pay for it, and we advise and will support all private insurance companies not to pay for it unless the manufacturer of the catheter ablation trial actually does the trial.
I don't like that.
Why?
Because that should be a decision between the doctor and the patient, not by the Medicare authority.
You're a really good Republican.
it's a matter of what you're proposing, maybe, to change the standard that the FDA uses. So the FDA says safe and efficacious, and we would just say, let's change that and say the FDA would say it has to be safe and efficacious when compared to the best available alternative. Those words, maybe.
Again, there's a difference between paying for it.
Someone has entered the conference.
There's a difference between paying for it and approving it for use. And there is a possibility, since some of you will hopefully wind up in government, since you're going to have to deal with some of these issues. Who should pay for it? What is the argument about the company that makes the catheter ablation? Why do they not want to pay for it?
Because they have nothing to gain.
Sure they do.
Well, they have shown
it
that.
It comes out negative,
though. Yeah, I mean, well, what happens if the study is negative?
They can't get paid for it if it's positive, so. I mean, why would they gain? Why did Alaris come to Rand and ask us, you know, all of you use these new, I call them new, we use clips when we had IVs, you know, you guys have these computerized systems with brains in them. Well, Alaris produces, I don't know which one UCLA uses, but Alaris has a brain in it that basically says, is this IV pole in a pediatric ward or an adult ward? That's the first question that you have to answer. And the importance of that is when you're giving drugs and you, it tells you something about, you know, don't give this amount of drug if you're living in a pediatric, you have to override it. So it tells you whether it's in a pediatric or an adult ward. Then you have to enter the solution you're giving and what you want to do with it. And it will determine the rate. And then you can put in guidelines into this machine that will prevent, that will prevent you from overdosing. So you can't run a, if you're honest and you do all this plugging in, it's like the airplane pilot plugging in, you know, to the computer. And you could make it do twice or three times and it keeps a paper record. So it's a sophisticated brain. They came to Rand and said, will you evaluate the impact, and one ex fellow here, evaluate the impact on cost and quality. We want to know whether we save lives, and we want to know whether, because we prevent adverse events and you don't have to resuscitate those people. So this is a comparative effectiveness study. It's against an IV pole that doesn't have this brain. It's not a clip, doesn't have this brain, and one that has a brain. It's a classic comparative effectiveness study. Now, I'm head of Rand Health. How should I negotiate with Alaris to say we're going to do this study? Terry Nichols did this study. You know her. So how, what do I negotiate? So I can try to figure out whether we're all on the same page. What do I say? I don't want to do it because you produce cigarettes and you're killing people? What do I do?
No matter what the results, you'd be allowed to publish.
So we have absolute publication rights. Okay? All right? Anything else?
Pay up front.
you do contract. Right? They're not gonna not pay me. I mean,
study design issues.
Who controls the study design? Yeah, we control the study design. Do we ask them their input?
Sure.
What else do I do?
Let them review the results.
What?
Let them review the results before we publish them. Not that that'll change it, but at least.
Okay, you can say, you can even, would you be comfortable? No surprises, we'll let you see the results. So when we tell the Pentagon, as we do, that they're killing people because they're producing post-traumatic stress syndrome, should we at least tell the generals before we tell the Wall Street Journal that, you know, no surprises? Is that okay? I mean, you have the right to do all this, because you always can say no. What? Anything else you'd want? would you be comfortable with me doing that study?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's what we did. They signed the agreement. What happened? Fast forward a year later, what happened? We found the thing doesn't save lives and doesn't save money. Terry is 1 year older than you are. She's probably younger, but she's been through the program.
It's been a few more years than that, but...
There you are. So what happened, Terry? I didn't even see you there.
Oh, really? That's yeah, we didn't find that the pumps addressed very many medical errors that did anything to people, and the events didn't actually generate any costs at one of the hospitals we looked at. And the Alaris was not happy, but we published it anyway.
Yeah, but what did they do? What were the set of conversations you and I had with the CEO of Alaris?
Yeah, so, you know, I went down there and went over the drafts with them, and they would try to pressure me to change this and that, and, you know, all this. And then at one point they were like, well, maybe we'll do follow-on research. I was like, yeah, right. But, yeah, so they tried a few different strategies, too.
So one of the things is Terry had probably the best insight into why these pumps, how these pumps could be changed to be effective. Because not only did we learn why they were not effective, but we also knew what should be done to correct it. I mean, she read 4,000 records or whatever the number was. I mean, she spent her life trying to look at this for a couple of years. And she had good information. So one of the options the company told us was the following. If you don't publish this, we will give you another follow-up grant to help look at something that we want to do. So what was our response?
Basically, I just, you know, was like, well, I'll see it when I believe it. I mean, they didn't put it in quite such stark terms, but they were kind of moving in that direction, and I was like, well, you know, I'm happy to talk about follow-on work, but those were like totally, you know, unrelated.
So I had a set of conversations also with them, and the response was, I said, Terrell is a lovely human being, but she has 19 kids, and it's going to take a year before this year to year, and then she'll submit this in a few months. We'll rewrite it a number of times. Then the journal will tell us that since it's a negative study, that it will be really hard to get it published, and we'll have to take a while to get it published. We have a long lead time. We are going to publish this, but we have a long lead time to work with you. So when this result actually comes out, you can have a new pump. Now, I think the CEO should have been fired when he said they don't want to take advantage of this deal. Now, the bottom line is, did it have any effect on the market?
No.
Well, do we know?
No, I mean, it did not have any effect on the market. They're used in most hospitals now, and there's a lot of groups that are, you know, advocating for it, like national equality groups.
So ask Terrell why?
Well, ours was not the only study. There have been no studies that are real studies that have looked at, like, outcomes and have shown any effect. All of the studies that have looked at real outcomes.
So if you take Terrell and say she has a 40-year work life, and she spent 2 of those years doing this study, and elegantly, you know, ethically, morally, in an organization that supported her. And at the end, we lost business, because no follow-up work, so she had to find something else to do. We lost business, and we had no impact on doctors, because the journals, because it was anti what they expected to find. And what Terrell really, we all expected to find, we thought this was a no-brainer, that, you know, that we would find a positive impact. And because we didn't, and the world thought it was relegated to a lower level journal than if it had been positive. Just like you said, we worked really hard to get it published. It took a lot of work to get it published. Teams changed, people left, but we worked really hard to get it published. And who won? So now let's come back to the question. Why aren't the Republicans fighting against comparative effectiveness research because nobody uses it? Why are they doing it the other way? If they're against waste in government, waste in medicine, controlling the federal deficit, why aren't they fighting the other way around? Why are they not fighting for funding this kind of, making more of this information available.
Aren't there a whole bunch of Republicans out there, like people I know who are Republican and they want low taxes but don't touch their Medicare?
So is it all about votes? Is it all about, you know, that elderly people vote? And so if that's the case, why do any comparative effectiveness work at all, no matter who funds it? I mean, why do it at all? If it's not going to be used. So if the results come back negative from this study, so let's look at the study again. And this is the number one priority, the reason I'm focusing on it. The number two has to do with cochlear implants. These are the priorities of the best that medicine, this is what, when the NIH and the agency said, we haven't the foggiest idea because none of you will go to work in the government. We don't have anybody there. We have no physicians. None of you want to go to work in the government. We pay too low salaries. You know, you don't want to live in Washington in the heat in the summer. You know, you prefer the beach and surfing, and so we're not going to go to work in Washington. So none of them here had any idea how to implement this damn bill of $1.1 billion. So they turned to the federal government, I mean to the IOM, which is made up of a bunch of gray-haired old men, and they basically got them around a table, produced some evidence, very little analysis, and ask them to come up with a list. And you should read this list. This is what the best consensus judgment is. And there's some interesting things on it, comparing disease management programs, some delivery issues. So you know, it took a lot of pressure to push them away from just doing these simple, but this is the top issue on their list. I don't know how much money, and I don't know if the NIH actually funded a single study to deal with priority number one. I just don't know. We ought to be able to find out. By probably Googling it, and you probably can find out much faster than I can. But the question is, why wouldn't Republicans, why, when you look at Alan Garber's article about polarization, why weren't the Republicans interested in funding this? And why shouldn't they be interested in funding it? And the argument goes back and forth this way. Even if I set up these criteria, if I tell a company, usually it's a small company, so some of you may actually decide you want to do something. So you have to know that you really want to be an inventor. You don't want to just study the problem, sit in an academic office and do nothing. You actually want to do something. And what you may want to do, like, I mean, Ron spent his life designing surveys. I mean, very atypical. He actually developed a product. I mean, he did something. You may actually want to do something. And you may want to say, I could build a better catheter. And I'll go into my garage and build a better catheter. And then I got to get some money to prove that this is safe and effective. I don't have the same resources that I have as a pharmaceutical company. I don't have these resources. So I'm a small business. Should I put on the back of the small business that they have to prove that this catheter is not only safer, but more effective than medical therapy before I'll let it to be used? Should I require them to do that? So it's anti-small business. Now, nobody will talk that way, but it's anti-small business to require them to do that. Now, should I fund it at all? And you may be right. You may be that people believe that there will be enough information generated without government funding about this. So Lenny will decide that he's going to do this study because he's altruistic. He now became a Democrat. He's altruistic. And he is going to do this study out of the goodness of his heart for no money while he lives in a garage and eats peanut butter sandwiches and actually do the study like Drew has been trying to do with implementing an IT system. You know, I mean, people do that with no hope of ever getting any rich or any money, but that's what he wants to do. And then he will get the Medal of Freedom Award and we'll call him Mother Teresa. I mean, you could do some of that. Some of you can actually do that. But who funds this work is a really important question. So I came along and wrote an editorial which will make me impossible. You may want to read it. That said, because I never can get a job after I wrote it. And I basically said that there ought to be a business case for this field. That if the federal government is going to spend money, there has to be two things. One, you have to know whether it saves money or doesn't save money, as well as what it does with health. So you have to measure costs. If you go through any of the major journals right now and you look at studies that either evaluate technology or evaluate quality, almost never do they have a cost measurement. So I said, it's got to tell me what happens to dollars, number one. And there has to be, if you're in an institution, and, so if UCLA gets a grant, and you're studying this, and Robin proves that, you know, catheter ablation doesn't work, UCLA has to stop doing it. And I have to commit up front with a letter from the CEO and the head of cardiology that up front they will stop doing this. Otherwise, Robin can't get the grant. We'll give it to a guy at Harvard. I wrote, that's what I wrote in 1,200 words, which means that, now, the people that wrote me back, it's very interesting. I got letters from Victor Fuchs and Rashi Fine, who are two of the gray-haired economists, who said, this is the most important piece that has been ever written on this field, and you may want to read it. I'm sure I also got a lot of other letters back that said, I wish you were in hell quicker than you are, and what if it hell's too good for you? But the bottom line here is that that should we, if we are going to take federal money, this is federal money that could be used to feed people or to help buy homes, it's $1 billion, and if we're going to do comparative effectiveness work, then we ought to at least have a business case and we at least ought to measure costs. Now there's one other thing when you look at this list. I didn't have this list before I wrote this thing. You can do a modeling approach to this list. And the modeling approach to this list is as follows. You could ask the question, if I spend my life studying number one or 3 years, what difference will it make depending if the results come out A, B, or C? We spend an enormous amount of time in science looking at marginal differences. You guys are very special people in terms of your abilities. And we spend a lot of time looking at marginal differences. And you ought to at least do a back-of-the-envelope calculation of saying, well, in my wildest imagination, this may be 5% better than this. Remember, it has to get through an IRB. So the IRB has to say it's equal. I mean, if you're sitting on the IRB. So by allowing you to study this in a design that does not just use observational data, and you may just be using observational data, in a real design other than observational, you have to basically convince an IRB that you would give one or the other to your mother or mother-in-law. Okay, depending if you have no differences in feelings. Okay, that's what you would have to convince, right? That's what you're supposed to do if you're in an IRB. So by their very nature, many of these things may make very small differences, either in cost or quality or health. Should you be spending your time doing that or spending your time doing something else? So I'll compare two numbers that the CMS and the government have done. They spent $1 billion for this. They spent $1 million under the health reform law. There is a provision that they have to determine what a minimum benefit is. They gave the job, again, for all the plans that are going to be implemented starting the year 2014. They gave $1 million of money to the IOM to try to define what a minimum benefit package is for healthcare in healthcare. $1 million, and they spent $1 billion on this. Think about it in terms of what's going on. Now, if you want to read more about polarization, just so for those of you that are interested in polarization, there is marvelous work done. Actually, I can, anyone who wants to email me, the CEO of RAND did a whole set of research on the subject. There's a whole science of polarization in Congress. And by polarization, we tend to mean, is there anybody in the middle? Just to be clear, is there anyone? I set this up to be confrontational. It wasn't very confrontational. But the bottom line is there anyone in the middle? And you can look at the way Congress votes, and it's been recorded since the 18-some, go back as far as you want. And you could then look at, grade those votes on the basis of, I think it's liberal versus Democrat, but you can do analyses, and you can actually show that there are people in some Congresses where they vote in both different blocks, that there are people in the middle, that you don't have 100%. you know, voting record that supports one group or 100% that supports the other group. And you can plot the polarization of Congress over time. Right now, we're in an extreme place in the polarization in American democracy in Congress. You're living in an extreme time. There's nobody in the middle at all. The last time that there was an enormous number of people in the middle was right after World War II, where there were most people in the middle and there were very few people on the... So it's almost like a bipolar distribution now. And so in that kind of a... And it talks about the forces that moves people to move back into the middle. So when income distribution in the country becomes more different, so it becomes wider, and the Gini score gets higher, lower? What is it, Adam? Higher or lower for income distribution? Higher? Okay, when it shows more income, you know, dispersion, gets higher, then the bottom line is that there are forces that pull it towards the middle. So you could, in terms of what happens, those forces are not as prevalent today. And there are two thoughts for the people, the historians, and I'm going to leave you with that because it's a long way away from clinical effect. And two forces that people believe why that hasn't occurred today in America. The first is that we have too many felons, and felons can't vote. So we've made a large part of the population they can't vote. So because they can't vote these people out of office. You can vote if you have Alzheimer's disease. If you don't know the year, really, if you don't know the year or who you are, you can vote. But you can't vote if you're a felon. You ought to think about that. Somebody may want to write a paper about that. I mean, the 2012 election will be determined by people who don't know the year. You know, I'm serious. I mean, that's what happened in Florida. You all thought it had something to do with the ballot. Absolutely not. It had to do with people that were voting that weren't oriented to time, person, and place, a medical problem. Not a technical computer problem, a medical problem. I'm serious. That's what happened. Close election, people who aren't oriented are the ones that are going to determine who wins the election in the United States. That's democracy in action. So that's the first part of this thing. The second part of it is immigration. That because there are all of these new immigrants in the country, and the question is, there is the when you plot periods in American history when there's immigration, there's less willingness to share, and you have to absorb the immigrants over a year, over a generation. So the people that have been writing this whole history of why we're so polarized right now, and why Alan Garber could write this article, is because of these two factors. Well, I mean, if the population becomes less dominated by new immigrants, and if we do something about felons, then you might argue that we will swing back to a less polarized world. And then in it, you will be able to answer the question, really, who ought to do this? My belief is that this was the way comparative effectiveness work came out. It was a full employment act for health services researchers, even though they spent an awful lot of time wasting money writing grants. But it was really a full employment act. And I don't know why health services researchers were picked out as opposed to architects or, you know, civil engineers or somebody else. I have no idea why they were considered to be more valuable. But because the likelihood that any of this stuff will really be used, I am really worried about it. And one of you ought to decide you want to write a history of this and figure out what happens to this stuff, whether it's used, whether it really acted as a stimulus, what did it actually do? Did it get rid of waste? Did it do anything? Or did it take the best and the brightest? See, what happens is we're all like pigs at a trough. And once, you know, we put money in front of you or food, we react to money. Some of us react to food. Most of you react to money. Once we throw money in front of you, you go run after the trough. And so we put a trough together called, you know, comparative effectiveness, and everybody, there were more applications received by the NIH than it blew their system. They couldn't even download applications off their system. We all ran because we all thought we'd get money, and everybody ran to it. There was nobody that called up and said, hey, instead of writing 100 applications, let's share the wealth. It'd be really interesting. I don't know if it's illegal, but it'd be really interesting if everyone called up and said, can we trust each other enough? We'll just pull straws, we'll do something, but instead of writing 100 applications for every run that gets funded, let's write 5. and let's do it by, let's eliminate by just random pulling straws or something. But we have no belief structure of trying to do that. So we spent a lot of money, probably more money than we got doing this, but it really was a full employment act. So I would like to see it changed. And you can be assured that I will never go to Washington because of what I wrote. So, you know, that's where we are.
You like surfing.
So, anyway, we probably have no time, but if you want questions for a few minutes more, we can talk about things. I mean, I'm sure you all disagree with everything I said, but that's all right.